Welcome back to Ladies with Gumption, episode 183, Search Protocol. I am May, and I'm here with
Tatiana
and Jessica.
We recap DCTV in a flash. You can usually find all of our podcast episodes over on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify. Podomatic is our main host, and you can send us all your asks over on Tumblr at ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, over to Gmail at ladieswgumption@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter for all our salty, happy tweets at DCTVGumption. We do have Patreon, so if you are new listeners, we have basically a Patreon set up to give you more episodes that are outside of the DCTV that is on network television, such as you get things like HBO Max Premium, things like Doom Patrol. We've done Titans in the past. We no longer do Titans.
Maybe we should add a premium member. You pay us $20
for all the Titans.
watching through all our shady thoughts. We also do popular Netflix series like You, The Witcher. We're going to do Bridgerton. We did Turning the Red last week, The Batman before that. So lots to love. So if you're interested in supporting us, go over to patreon.com/DCTVGumption. Over in the news, we have Sharon Stone has been cast as, where am I?
Victoria Cord,
yes. So that's pretty exciting. That's a really big name for this movie. And I feel like they've really rounded out the cast with some great people. So I'm really looking forward to this. And then we have Rahart Adam.
I think it's Rahart. Yeah.
No worries. As Brody on Gotham Knights.
Who is Brody even supposed to be? That sounds like a fake name.
Yeah. I feel like it's a cover up for Dick, Tim, whoever they're going to pick as.
No, but isn't like the other, because I thought the other dude was, well, I guess it doesn't exclude him from being Bruce's adopted son, but wasn't like the other dude his adopted son or something?
See, that's what I'm confused about, because they did say that, I think, but then they listed Rahart as the lead of the show.
So the lead or a lead?
I don't know. Great questions you ask. Let's see. Adams. Okay, as a lead. So he is one of several.
I guess it's going to be like an ensemble regardless, right?
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's interesting to see what they do with it, I guess. You know, they're probably going to film a pilot very soon. And over at the Oscars, which was interesting this year.
Gotham Knights, did we say like about Anna Lore? Because she was also Stephanie Brown. Did we talk about that last week?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I'm looking at Gotham Knights updates just in general.
Oh, we had a Gotham Knight update last week. I just assume it was her because she was the only cast.
Yeah.
That came out last week.
Just like begrudgingly accepting its existence over Batwoman. That's why I'm like,
yeah.
We'll see how I feel.
Excitement is not there.
Exactly. But soon, maybe. If Batwoman's renewed, then I'll be super excited.
Over in the DC world, at the Oscars, for reasons unknown, the Flash Speed Force scene won Zack Snyder's Justice League fan
cheer. It was like a fan voted award.
Fan cheer, yeah, and it was really confusing.
Like, one time that DC fanboys, you know, persevered like over Marvel. Like Spider-Man: Homecoming was in there too. Like,
yeah,
finally, you defeated
really
them.
Interesting. Yeah, I figured Marvel would win, but I guess not, which is fine. But then what was interesting, though, is that I think even Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead movie also got a fan cheer. And I'm just like, this is interesting.
Snyder bros are working overtime, man.
Yep.
Indeed.
Almost wish that Cinderella had won over Army of the Dead. But oh,
that would have been a shakeup. No one would have seen it.
It got second place, okay? Cinderella was in second place, but you're almost there.
Wait, what's her face? Is Camila Cabello Cinderella?
Cinderella. Because it was literally just a Twitter fan army voting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, only movies that have a Twitter army behind them.
Yeah, feel like that's an interesting, like, the Oscars is an interesting place for that stuff because it's, you know, historically not been the case. But just as the Flash entered the Speed Force, he exited the Speed Force into reality when Ezra Miller attacked some people at a karaoke bar in Hawaii. And now he has a restraining order against him filed by, I think, two people because he allegedly, like, burst into somebody's room.
Yes. Yeah. It said that they attacked a couple in...
Because I think they were staying at the Airbnb of the couple. Like, they were renting out, like, a room. And for some reason...
They ran into the room and were like, I'm going to kill you and your slut wife. And apparently, I heard also that they stole, like... documents or credit cards or something. Like, I was like, excuse me?
That is just unhinged behavior.
And this is after the Flash movie has also been, like, pushed back again. Mm-hmm. So it just feels like, you know, I don't know.
The curse continues.
But obviously, like, it just suggests that it was not a one-off when they had choked the fan that last... Was it last year or 2 years ago?
I think it was last year.
Yeah. People kind of, like, let it slide after a bit. And even though no one is going to defend the KKK, well, some people might, but I also think that their video message to the KKK was also indicative of the general unhinged
behavior
binge they were going on. Yes.
Yeah. So we don't really know what's going to happen there. I feel like they've almost done filming the movie anyway. And
I think they're done. And they've done like some screenings of it, right? Mm-hmm. They've done screenings of the movie. So it's not like you can go back and just like redo Ezra's scenes.
Not to mention that Fantastic Beasts is coming out in 2 weeks.
True.
Yeah. And I feel like it's really hard in this case because he is the star of the movie. Like with the whole Death on the Nile thing, they could, like, softly erase Armie Hammer's existence because it's an ensemble. And so it's like, well, let's talk to everybody else and just ignore the fact that he was in the movie. But
or, like, West Side Story with Ansel Elgort.
Yeah. So I don't know what will happen. Like, the press tour, I doubt.
I saw someone suggest that just put it on HBO Max and just don't make a lot of fanfare about it.
After all this time, can you imagine it just goes on HBO Max?
I feel like you just have to, like, you know, because the production company WB sunk a lot of money into it, obviously. Yeah. You know, so if you don't have money to go back and just redo all of Ezra's scenes, so just put it on like HBO Max. Don't do a lot of fanfare for it. You've got other stuff on HBO Max anyway, you know, and let that be the end of it.
This takes me all the way back to when fans tweeted at Grant that Ezra was the better Flash. In hindsight.
Look where we are now.
That's why Grant's curse has lasted so long and so strong.
He was just so angry about that, you know. Like, curse this movie.
Exactly.
Eight years and nine seasons going strong, you know. In more drama news, we had the Oscars, the big, you know, talking moment was Will Smith. Yes, the slap heard around the world. Will Smith slaps Chris Rock after Chris Rock made a joke about Jada's baldness, which was what is it called
that she has
alopecia. Yes, and I know that they have a long, years long feud apparently that has been ongoing, and so I feel like he knew what he was doing, but same time, Will Smith.
And the fact that it was Oscar. Yeah,
no one knew if it was, like, real or not at the time. he just slaps him and then tells him to keep his wife out of his fucking mouth. So, wife's name. So there was a lot of people who had opinions on the matter. For me, it was, like, white people speaking up when they didn't need to, particularly. Especially since, like, they kept talking about not condoning violence when this country was, like, always pro-war and no one talked about January 6th the way that they should have and things like that. So it's kind of got out of hand.
And I feel like for me, it's also the fact that, you know, you can see, we all say, oh my gosh, violence is bad. And you can say that the action of slapping Chris Rock, you know, should he have done it? Probably not. But no one people like try to stop it at that point and say, oh, he shouldn't have done it. And that's the end of the conversation. When it's not the end of the conversation, the additional piece of this is that there is another assault, a verbal assault that, you know, Chris Rock made to Jada. And the question of should he have done that, especially since it was off script, it's not scripted. So, you know, there was no conversation of this is a joke I'm going to say. And the Smiths being like, don't say that joke or whatever, if it's ad-libbed. So, you know, the fact that that happened, that piece of it happened, and no one wants to talk about should that have happened, how does Jada feel? And there's no consideration of, like, Jada Pinkett Smith's feelings because people stop at Will Smith smacked Chris Rock, it was wrong, and therefore nothing can justify blah, 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 blah. You know, like, I feel like for a lot of non-Black people, it's just this, like, super, oh, my God, kind of conversation. But for, like, a lot of Black people, it's like, you know, growing up, you knew, talk shit, get hit. It's just not, it's not even saying that it's justified. It's like, these are the facts of if you assault someone verbally, be prepared for the fact that they might respond physically. And that is what happened in this case. And I just feel like, you know, it kind of, everyone is focusing on one thing. And the stupid thing about, like, the media about it is that the media acts so outraged about this traumatic moment that happened to Chris Rock. And yet in one media package, they will play that slap 3 or 5 times. And accompanying that slap, they'll play the fact that, you know, what led up to the slap, which was Chris Rock saying the comment about Jada Pinkett Smith. So you have two people in the situation that faced a quote-unquote trauma to them, one being physical, one being verbal, and everyone's like, oh my God, the humanity, but they keep replaying that traumatic moment over and over again, and yet they say that, you know, oh my God, you know, it's just like ridiculous to a point. It's become that way. But back to, like, the D.C. side of it, we had people that from D.C. that commented on it. One was Stephen Amell, which he just, it was very interesting because he
of
just
said the Stephen facts. Amell commented
what did
on
Stephen
it?
Amell say? I didn't even
know. He just said that, you know, he and his, like, I guess he was talking about his daughter. We were watching the Oscars. Like, I just saw someone get smacked on TV, and he left it there. So it's very, like,
okay, we love it when we
objective.
Just like
facts. And then he shut the fuck up, which was great. It was very much growth on his part. Like, I feel like he learned from his Beachella days to not speak on Black people's business. So that was good. He stopped right there. And then, like, on the other side of it, you had Zoe Kravitz. She didn't even say anything out loud. She just posted, like, a photo on Instagram with, you know, here's me in a pretty dress where we apparently assault people at the Oscars now or whatever. And then people started, you know, digging up receipts from her past, her daddy's past. Everybody's past. Like, everybody can get it at this point. So it's just kind of, like, funny, the two opposite spectrums of reactions from, like, DC actors to what happened.
Yeah. I like what you said about the whole, like, people not really talking about the verbal assault of it all, because I feel like the conversation at first started off with blaming Will and talking about Will and how he was wrong. And, you know, regardless of whatever Chris Rock said, he was wrong. But it's like the whole conversation with, you know, I don't know, your middle school bully. It's like, oh, well, I finally hit him. But what was it that led up to that moment, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, like, you know, there are better ways to go about such things. But also acknowledging the fact that, like, Chris Rock did say something that was out of line, you know, and what he said was out of line. And I feel like that goes, and that ties back into, like, the whole conversation about comedy in the 21st mm-hmm. century, and, like, how comedians specifically, like, using targeted words against people as, like, an attack, a personal attack, is not, like, if that's what you need to be funny, I don't know. It's just, like, a whole conversation that is you know, beyond this podcast. But
I agree with both of your perspectives. However, I will just give the latest update, which is Will Smith resigned from the Academy of Motion, whatever, blah, blah, blah.
Really?
Academy. Yes. And this was a statement. I have directly responded to the Academy's disciplinary hearing notice, and I will fully accept any and all consequences for my conduct. My actions at the 94th Academy Awards presentation were shocking, painful, and inexcusable. The list of those I have hurt is long and includes Chris, his family, many of my dear friends and loved ones, all those in attendance, and global audiences at home. I betrayed the trust of the Academy and deprived the other nominees and winners of the opportunity to celebrate and be celebrated for their extraordinary work. I am heartbroken and want to put the focus back on those who deserve attention for their achievements and allow the Academy to get back to the work it does to support creativity and artistry in film. So I'm resigning from membership in the Academy, blah, blah, blah. Will accept any further consequences the board deems appropriate. And I will never allow violence to overtake reason. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing.
I mean, I think he's doing all that he can do to just be like, you know, let us in this conversation that should have ended like days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting though that like the reaction from the Academy specifically.
What if it was Betty White? What if Will was named A47?
Yeah, right. But I just think the fact that because we all saw it, it was visual, mm-hmm. people were just like,
yeah. But
they've had a history of, you know, awarding awards to
rapists
and criminals and whatever, Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, what have you, and they're still part of the Academy. So it's like, I don't know. It's just
but, yeah.
conversation. I agree. Like the only difference
on Will's part to just say like, you know, this is my I'm taking like a proactive stance.
Like he's taking ownership of his
No, you can't take it away from me if I step back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I was going to say something else, and I completely blanked. that happened. And then we have the Umbrella Academy season 3 is reintroducing Vanya Hargreaves as Victor Hargreaves to acknowledge Elliot Page's transition. And so that's going to be interesting, like story wise, for the Vanya character to see like where that goes.
And I feel like it answers like a question that we talked about when we discussed Umbrella Academy season 2 on Patreon, plug. But, you know, because we asked the question, you know, once Elliot came out and affirmed his gender, would it feel uncomfortable to have to then go back to play this female character on the show, and how are they going to handle that? And this is like the answer now that we're getting now is that they are handling it by reintroducing the character as Victor Hargreaves to align with Elliot. So I think that's a good choice, and it's good how the show's kind of like supporting their actor. So.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting Victor and seeing. I mean, I guess it also makes sense too. Like we're in a new timeline, so we can have a new.
Yeah, and then also it kind of makes sense because we get Victor without there being question of whether Victor has season 1, season 2 memories.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to go through the how does this work kind of thing. So I think that's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So looking forward to that. I think it comes out in June. So we will talk about it on Patreon. But getting back to DC TV, we'll be discussing our joys, no joys, and Lady with Gumption of the Week for Naomi and The Flash. And to take us away is the lovely Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
So over on Naomi's side A, the contingency plan. In this episode, new information leads Naomi to believe there is an alien in her midst, and it may be someone she knows. Jacob's device narrows down the anniversary party guest list to 3 possible suspects on Naomi Street the night of the theft of the disc. And quinky dink, they are the 3 people that are in love with Naomi, Nathan, Anthony, and Lourdes. To catch their friends in a lie without letting on that they know, Jacob and Annabelle and Naomi devised a very specific Never Have I Ever game with Naomi acting as human lie detector to see whose heartbeat betrays them. Surprisingly, it's Nathan who draws the most suspicion, causing a breach in trust between the newly Facebook official couple, but not getting the answers that she wants from Nathan when she tries to confront him without really saying what she's asking him about, which he can kind of pick up on. She doesn't get the answer she wants, but needing to be sure, Jacob suggests to Naomi that under a certain film exposure, aliens have a blue glow around their eyes. So to test this theory out, Naomi asks Anthony to take photos of all the guests at the party while she and Lourdes go to the school to get necessary chemicals needed to process these photos to see who has a blue glow. Meanwhile, a visit from Commander Steele prompts Dee to go to Zimbabwe and say, like, you know, there's something suspicious going on here. And they make an unexpected visit to the McDuffie home in the middle of the anniversary party, dressed to the nines, which Dee, throughout the party, casually undresses. So they arrive in style, but, you know, Dee is like, this is restrictive. I need my body to be free. I need to breathe. So he starts taking off his clothes, which is hilarious. At the party, Dee's invited Greg and Jen come up with a plan to protect Naomi, with Z and J going to the military base to initiate the contingency plan, which is the plan to frame Commander Steele and throw all suspicion off their way, while G and D monitor the party. Back at school, Naomi and Lourdes have a moment together in the photo room before they're interrupted by Nathan, who is sneaking into school to break into Naomi's locker. Her suspicions at an all-time peak, she confronts him only to discover that he was actually not an alien. He just wanted to surprise her with a proposal, which is very cute. Finally, this whole episode has flash forwards to an interrogation of Naomi and her friends about the night in question, and slowly they begin to unfold to reveal that it was Steele. He was under the police are investigating him for alien conspiracy theories, which is Jennifer's contingency plan, and the fact that he was stalking the McDuffies. After Nathan leaves the school upset, Steele, undeterred by his visit to an interrogation of Greg at the McDuffie party, and Greg's denials, he goes to the school to find Naomi and confront her about being an alien with the intent to expose her and kill her. Back into a corner, Naomi races to have to use her powers to defend herself when she is saved by, her parents, who are unaffected by the human kryptonite. I can't remember the name of this stone thing, whatever.
Yeah, same.
It's just human kryptonite. They use to incapacitate Steele. But she knows from episodes ago at the campsite that only humans are affected by this, and so why aren't her parents affected by this? Shaken, she confirms this by processing all of the photos from the party. And she processes one of her and her parents, and surprise, surprise, all three of them have blue eyes. Her parents are freaking aliens, and they never
White Walkers.
Charles Stone III directed the episode, written by Rebecca Bellotto. What sparked joy?
Well, first off, I liked the whole setup of the episode. I liked the way that it was framed as like whodunit police investigation, like an episode of Elite. It definitely upped the stakes for the episode and had me questioning, like, what is each character lying about? How are they framing things to the police versus how do things really happen overall? Very enjoyable. Also, I really felt for Naomi, like, when she was giving that speech about, like, her parents' love and, like, whatever, and looking around the party and wondering, like, who at this party is the person I cannot trust or whatever. I was like, aw, that must be so hard. but, like, you know, not sarcastically. I was like, aw, that was good. Good job, actress who plays Naomi, whose name I've forgotten. I also really liked
Casey Walsh.
Yes, thank you. I also really like seeing Naomi and Annabelle and Jacob like have a teaming up again, playing detective, trying to figure out who done it, and using the Never Have I Ever game, which I also like that the friends quickly caught on and were like, wait a second, this is a very specific
like,
game.
There were some very specific questions.
Yeah. So that was enjoyable. I also
never have I ever been on Naomi Street on Sunday at 7 o'clock.
Like, what? and I did like that, you know, we used the powers of deduction to be like, okay, well, it can't be Anthony. And then I love when Lourdes is like, well, I'm not even going to tell you what I was doing. But sometimes people have secrets. Plus, yes, Nathan, you know, thinking it was going to be Nathan and then getting to be relieved that it wasn't Nathan was a fun twist. I also thought that Steele was, like, properly creepy. He did feel like he would pose a threat. First, I was worried about Greg in that conversation, and then I was worried about Naomi, and then I thought she was really going to expose herself when she's about to use her powers, and then saved at the last second. Speaking of which, then it turned out that who she was saved by was her parents. And her parents were aliens, too. Oh, my God. That was great in terms of dramatic impact, heightened the stakes for future episodes, and certainly gives Naomi a reason to feel, like, the most betrayed. Because there's no one that would be more of a betrayal lying to her about who they are than her own parents, who already know who she is. So, like, why wouldn't there be
a hidden that from her for so long?
Yeah, exactly. So that was, like, perfect. Plus, it gives us a couple of answers to our questions that we had before about, like, the rest of the heroes and, you know, where Zimbadu, like, who Zimbadu is interacting with and, like, what are his goals or whatever. So now we understand why there's so much history between the parents and Zimbadu. And it was, like, yes, Jen's plan, or, like, the plan in general to frame Steel was great. It was fun to watch some hacking and some spying and some lying to federal authorities. All great. That is all.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
I like this episode a lot in general. I just like the setup with regards to everyone talking to, I guess, police about what happened at the party and getting asked questions. But I like we didn't really get to see, like, the other side and how, you know, first of all, I was really surprised. I was like, I guess they've been in Port Oswego for a long time. I was like, they know so many people. We don't know any of these people except for, like, five. but I really liked just the vibe of the episode and how all of the characters being together actually worked, especially, like, the Never Have I Ever game, or how Annabelle and Naomi and Jacob are all just kind of, like, on one team and everybody else felt alienated from them. But we also got to see, like, little tidbits of Anthony, Nathan, and Lourdes's new friendship after last week, which is really nice. And I like the fact that it was just a big mystery. It's like, we don't really know who the alien is. And the whole time I was thinking, Jessica's in my head, is like, Lourdes is going to be the alien. But discovering the fact that her parents were the aliens was just really, like, I don't know why I guess we didn't see that coming. I know her dad in the comics.
Because it wasn't there.
Right, it wasn't there. You see. her dad in the alien, her dad in the comics is an alien, so I guess it shouldn't be too surprising, but, like, the way that the show played it out, because they've painted the parents as, like, these very, like, loving couple who just dote on their daughter. They have no issues. They're just the sweetest people.
Slightly ignorant about the scope of the situation.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just to find out that they've known all along and that they have secrets that Naomi does not know was very, very, it was a great twist, because I feel like it makes them a lot more interesting than they were, mm-hmm. which is great for the story, because if they're going to be such a part of Naomi's life, they need to be more than kind of like the outsiders who are just trying to protect their daughter. So that, I love that. And the fact that it all had to do with Commander, what's his face? Was it Steel?
Steel, which is funny because I keep thinking about Legends whenever I hear the name. I'm like, Nate, what is he doing?
Yeah. And then, like, Zimbadu. And
his dad could be like that, you know?
It's true, yeah.
We could do a crossover universe here.
Zimbadu and Dee just being at the party was hilarious. And I like that they continue working together, but Dee's like, you know, has to dress for the occasion. And I think Annabelle was telling him, she was saying, like, that's tight.
That's, he's
like,
tight.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
It was hilarious. And Annabelle, like, you know, dipping in her toes in what she knows about crime mysteries through Agatha Christie novels was great, too. So all of, like, the little touches here and there really capitalized on the relationships of the characters and made the episode all the better. And just, like, finally feels like we're really moving forward with this twist, because it was stuck on, like, the Naomi aspect of it for so long, and now we're just getting a lot more information, and I love that. I think it's a great place to keep or put the cliffhanger for, like, the 3-week break that they're going on. And it was such a great episode. So I have, you know, that's it. It was just fun.
Yeah, I love this episode, and I feel like the last few episodes of Naomi have really found their groove and where they want to be as a show. And I want to say the last episode that I hated was the summer camp episode. I don't remember the episode after that, but I feel like that was the last one that left an impression in my mind. Yeah, that was the one I hated Anthony. And then the next one, him and Nathan found common ground or whatever. So I feel like now we're really getting into the groove, and I hope they continue on this journey, because I think these last few episodes are indicative of why it could and could possibly get a season two, and the argument for it getting a season two, because I feel like it's really starting to find its identity. This episode in particular, I like the comparison you made, Tati, to it being Elite, because it does feel kind of like a Elite type setup, and where you have different characters giving their perspective. We don't really know if how much they're, because you know, some of our characters have more knowledge than they're going to let on to any kind of police investigation. So you have some slight misdirects and bluffing or lies going on in those, and you don't know who they're talking to, and you have this, because I was really confused in the beginning when the opening shot is Naomi at school. I'm like, how did she get to school? We were at the anniversary party. Where is this? Is this the next day? What's going on here? So the whole opening of something has happened to someone, and you don't know who that someone is, and you know that there's this investigation, so you're trying to figure out through the interrogations of who is being talked to and who is having these conversations, you're trying to cross off your list mentally of, okay, so nothing happened to Naomi, nothing happened to Annabelle, nothing happened to blah, 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 blah. And who haven't we talked to yet? Why haven't we talked to them? Were they the one in the beginning? And so there's all this kind of stuff. At first I thought they were talking to Commander Steele or someone in the military, because the previous episode, we know that Steele is closing in on the McDuffie family. So is it Steele interrogating them about what happened? Something happens, between Nathan and Naomi, because that was heavily hinted at. And then you have that with the suspicion of him being an alien. So all of that, I felt like was really the investigation style of it with the flashbacks really kind of helped ramp up the tension of the episode. And I think make it not just a standard bottle episode, because a standard bottle episode, last week when we were talking about it, it felt like it could have been kind of fillery. We were at the party last week, we're at the party this week, we're just fighting an alien, doesn't really feel like there's anything going on. But when you actually see the episode and the way they set it up, it adds a lot of suspense to something tragic has happened. Who of our cast has survived? Who of our cast is under suspicion? So I feel like the stakes were really high, even though it was a contained kind of episode. So I think that they handled that really nicely. I love the Never Have I Ever game. I was like, I hope they play Never Have I Ever. And when they did, I was like, yes. I think they need some practice at how to play Never Have I Ever, because their questions got a little really specific really quickly. But I did like the twist, or the red herring, I guess, that it was Nathan's heart that was speeding up, and what if he's the alien? Because he was the last person, Anthony is probably the last person on my list, but Nathan also, I was it's pretty safe that he's probably not an alien. So when he was failing Naomi's life changer test, I was like, why? What are you hiding? And I was bracing myself, because I know he didn't steal the disc, because I just feel that would be, why would you do that to your couple and have him working with the military? I don't like this kind of thing. So I'm worrying with myself about trying to brace myself for what's going on with Nathan. I really like the conversation that, and I like that, with Nathan and Naomi being a new couple, you have in the beginning with Naomi in the in her room with Jacob and Annabelle kind of plotting, and Nathan's like, hey, what are y'all guys doing? And she's kind of distracting him from that. So there's definitely stuff that she's withholding from him. And then she gets a moment of him not telling her the entire truth. And her conversation of you can tell me anything. You can tell, but she's not divulging that you can tell me because I'm also an alien. And I want you to be able to comfortable saying that you're an alien. So there's a lot of dancing around the subject. And I like that he could pick up on that, and he could feel that she wasn't necessarily being fully honest with him, I guess, because he's had experience in their previous relationship of that's kind of the reason why they broke up, is that he was open, but she was not as open. So I really, even though I liked her saying, about talking about trust and wanting to have this open communication with him, that he came back with, well, you're not really having open communication with me. And obviously, when we find out the real reason for him being shifty is that he just wanted to be cute and ask her out to prom, I just felt so bad for him. And the fact that, you know, in his investigation, at first I thought something happened to him because they'd been building up, you know, something between Nathan and Naomi at school. And then he was like one of the last interviews that we saw. So it's like, God, what happened to Nathan? But, you know, him still caring about Naomi and blaming himself for not being there when she was confronted by Steele, just kind of shows the kind of like person he is and how he wants to be able to support Naomi. So I felt like they had some really good scenes within that episode. I also liked Zimbadu and I always like Zimbadu and Dee when they are together and how they kind of like clash and they just kind of feel like super awkward, but they also just feel like they should go together. So I like them having like impromptu date night and going to like the McDuffie party. I loved when Dee was just like, I'm just gonna throw this on, and Zimbadu was like, do you have anything that's not black? And Dee's like, this is charcoal. Like the different shades of black was like super funny. And I like that Zimbadu let Dee dress him up and then slowly just take off all the clothes because they were just uncomfortable. Dee was just hilarious, fish out of water the whole entire night. And I love that the interactions between him and Annabelle and Jacob with the murder mystery party. I thought murder mystery was a great idea by Annabelle and Jacob to keep people invested in the party and staying at the house. So I like that. I liked Zimbadu and Jen's team up because this is the first time we had like a four parent summit for Naomi, all of Naomi gathered in a meeting of what to do to protect our girl. And I like that because we got the teenage Scooby gang and now we have the adult Scooby gang of Greg, Jen, Zimbadu, and Dee, and the different pairings of Greg and Dee and Zimbadu and Jen. So I liked that team up. We got to learn more. But now that we know, hindsight 2020, that Greg and Jen are aliens, it just kind of makes the conversation between her and Zimbadu at the military base like more interesting about who's withholding what and who knows what's best for Naomi and all this kind of stuff. So I thought that that was super interesting kind of conversation. I like the tension there. What else? Loris and Naomi had a moment in the photo room. Like, even though we already have like Nathan and Naomi now, I thought their little charged moment in the photo room was like super interesting. And I still feel like, even though I've been thwarted in my prediction, because I was so adamant that it had to be Loris and this whole thing was like leading up to be Loris, I still feel like there's something that she's hiding. But I just find it also interesting that she is very open about having secrets and that being some of like the allure or the mystery to her, that she is like, mind your business a little bit. And the fact that her appeal to Naomi is that you don't have to tell me everything. Like, Nathan needs to know everything or feels like he needs to know everything and have like this open, honest, like, communication. I want to be there for you. I want to know all of your secrets kind of thing. Loris is like, I don't even know that. And we can still be cool. So there's like a difference between Naomi's relationship with Loris and what Loris needs or what Loris asks of her versus her relationship with Nathan and what Nathan needs and what Nathan asks of her. And so I think there's like a difference of what does Naomi feel is more comfortable, having to be more vulnerable with Nathan or having secrets and Loris not asking her about it and being okay with that. So I thought that was kind of like an interesting little thing. Then obviously the twist that the whole time McDuffie family were aliens, that just like threw me. Like, I was not expecting that at all. I felt like that was such a good twist because I was so, even though I'm disappointed and I feel like my prediction would be a great one, I feel like this is equally as great just because I didn't expect it. And I think it adds a lot going into the final episodes of what can happen. So I thought that was a great, great twist. What did not spark joy?
Even you put it under spark joy, and like, I agree with everything you said, but I had under does not spark joy because I was like annoyed at Naomi because of it. So like Nathan was completely right when Naomi was like basically expecting her to, or like expecting him to trust her implicitly and tell her everything, even though she's obviously hiding secrets that she is not interested in sharing with him. But further, like more than that, I was a little bit like, well, I don't like what this means to the ship that she didn't like even give him the benefit of the doubt or like actually want to be like, well, no, it was not him. It's obviously not him because I love him and he is my boyfriend and he would never do that to me. So it was just like, all right, well, I guess I think it's him. And I was like, excuse me. But of course, if she had said it wasn't him, it would have ended up being him because that's just the nature of narrative storytelling. So, I mean, I guess it's good that the issue is that she does not trust him enough and needs to open up to him more. It's probably for the best. But in the moment, I did not like it. And then even after, he was still worried. Like you said, he's, like, worried about her and, like, you know, that the fact that he wasn't there for her. But I was like, no, you should still be mad because she was wrong. So anyway. aside from that, generally speaking, I do think it's a little bit, like, funny that this whole episode, she's like, well, who's betraying me? And I was like, okay, but, like, you don't actually know what their reasoning is. You're literally lying to all these people, which is why it makes sense. Like, there's nothing wrong with her keeping her identity a secret. That's really fine, because that's her right. But, like, then it's like, but they're also doing the same thing. And you don't know why they stole the disc or whatever. Or even if it is an alien who stole the disc, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, that's why I was like, okay, Naomi, relax. But then when the reveal came that it was her parents, then it's like, okay, well, that one actually, those are the people you should feel betrayed by for lying to you about the very thing that you just discovered about yourself that they were also lying to you about. So, like, it's like a double whammy. So yes, I support her in the end, but at first I was like, girl, it's fine. Also, like I just said, like I feel like even though I love the reveal of the parents from an emotional standpoint and like a stakes, etc., I feel like logically it just doesn't make sense. Like I'm like, why are they keeping this from her? Like, wouldn't it keep her safe to know what the situation is with all of them? Once she finds out about herself, what are you adding that extra layer for? And, like, why would it, like...
I feel like once she found out she was an alien, this should have been, like, we're also alien. And I feel like...
Yeah, exactly. Come to like Jesus moment.
A couple of weeks ago, we had their, like, love origin story. Mm-hmm. None of this was... the fact they're aliens was not a part of that.
Yes.
So it was, like, did they find her on the... Because they found her on the rock. So, like, they find her there because Mbado said, go here. You know,
right, like maybe that's how Zimbardo proved to them that he was not a hater. I don't know. And also, like, if Zimbardo has been helping them, like, they know who's, like, I guess, like, I can see that they didn't trust him because early on it seemed like he was the traitor or whatever, but then, like, by now they should know it's not the case, right? But they're still, like, mad at him. I don't know. Well, I guess we're just gonna see how much they retroactively actually knew. Mm-hmm. And then finally, even though I thought this was definitely one of my favorite episodes, the fact that Commander Steele was, like, neutralized so easily by the end of the episode, I'm like, are we back at square one now?
You still have Brutus.
Yeah, that's right. But, like, but where is Brutus? What has Brutus done?
True.
So that's why I was like...
For, like, a hot minute, I thought Steele was Brutus somehow. Right?
So I just felt like I was like, oh, my God, it was almost too easy in that. Like, I would have liked the tension to simmer a little bit more. But... for this episode, it was a really good episode. So, like, I'll just wait to see what they do next week. I'm not going to worry about next week now. There you go.
We're that's in 3 weeks.
You won't have to worry
about
it.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I was going to say next week.
Next month.
At all. I was also a little bit, you know, sad that Naomi immediately distrusted Nathan. Like, oh, you're hiding this from me. Even though no one owes you their secrets, especially your friends. Because you're not telling them anything either. But I think what frustrated me the most, and this is just like a minor thing, but I feel like based on the way that they've written the parents so far, they didn't really know they were going to be aliens until like several episodes
yes.
in writing the show.
Yes.
Otherwise, they would have been a lot more like solid with regards to where their story was headed and the scenes that they were given and what they said to different characters. Because otherwise, if you watch like the first three or four episodes, there's a lot of inconsistency there with how they're portrayed. And,
Especially because it reminded me of the first time Zubati like showed up at their home like unannounced, and they were like, "What are you doing here?" And we were like, "Why?" It seemed like they knew each other, or there's some kind of like in there, but it was like, this doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I guess it's supposed to make sense now because they're aliens, but even that, you know.
Yeah, and I feel like if they had held off on telling Naomi who she really was maybe for a while, like if we had not gotten their, you know, little love story early on, then I could see them going full flashback mode in the next episode after the big reveal. But it just feels like, you know, maybe they decided, the parents were like, maybe they're just a little bit too boring. Let's spice this up a little bit. So they're like, let's make it.
They knew that my lawyer's prediction was correct. He's like, let us pivot.
Yeah. So like, that's the only thing. It's just like the inconsistency of not having them be more of a presence throughout, and that they were like less engaging before and they were sort of written all over the place, and now they're aliens, and that's great. It's a great twist, but you know, I wish there was a better lead up towards that.
Oh, is it me? Yeah. It's like, who else hasn't done their joys? Oh, I haven't. Yeah, I agree with that. As much as I loved how surprised I was at the fact that it was the parents that are aliens and not Lourdes, I do feel like I was surprised because it came out of nowhere. Whereas I felt like Lourdes, there's a lot of like obvious, you know, misdirect or whatever, that it should be her. Because yeah, I do feel like it's very random that her parents are aliens now. And why didn't they tell her this, like, when she figured out that she was an alien herself, or, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And like, you guys, I agree with you guys that there didn't really seem to be a lot of hints in that direction. It felt more like they were human people that has this alien baby, and they feel like they're out of their depth a little bit. You know, they're trying their best, but to a certain extent, they're out of their depth because they don't understand alien diplomacy or whatever. But no, they've been aliens all along. So that, I thought that was, it'll be interesting to see how they explain that in the upcoming episodes. I didn't like Steel at all. And I guess it's narratively or however, like whatever the technical term is for how the story is broken out, it works because I'm not supposed to like him and he's supposed to be creepy. But I just felt very uncomfortable by not only his line of questioning with Greg. It felt very like xenophobic and all this kind of stuff. And then for him to go and stalk Naomi all the way to school, I'm like, what is wrong with you? Do you not see how like creepy this is? Like, you know, a grown man trying like stalking a child at her high school and threatening to expose her, and not only expose her, like he was there if she was an alien prepared to kill her. So it just felt very, I don't know. And I guess to Tati's point that he was, his plot point was resolved so quickly. He knew that the McDuffies were hiding something from him a couple episodes ago when they lied about the disc or whatever, and it, or the rock or whatever they found, and they lied about it. He knew that. And I feel like if we had gotten more episodes of maybe him actively doing the stalking or like, you know, checking up on other stuff that was lied about or taking pictures of Naomi's school or something like that, there would be a more steady build up to it. Or if at Star Labs, like we had talked about last week, of what if there was something on there that caught her recording of her being flagged as an alien or something like that, would have gradually built up the tension to that this was like a exploding point, instead of he knows they're lying, now he knows they're an alien, and now he's gone kind of thing. I don't know. But I don't have a lot of like dislikes to this episode. So I guess we'll move right along to feedback.
Yes. We have Suarez feedback for Naomi. He says, Naomi was a slow burn. Yes. He says, I didn't send my feedback last week. I was on a trip in Kurdistan and couldn't watch the shows. Glad to be caught up on them and the podcast.
Wow. It's a long trip.
Yes. Naomi was a slow burn in a good way this week. At first, I thought it was a tad underwhelming with the party plot, but the way the writers built it up was very good. Commander Steele is such a xenophobic, and I suspect racist dick. And I'm glad he got what was coming to him. The reveal that Naomi's parents were also aliens / multiverse people was so great and smartly done. I can't believe there are only 4 more episodes. I'm hoping that things ramp up in a way that changes the status quo for next season. Can't wait. Thanks, Swara.
As am I, Swara.
Do we have any predictions of where we go from here?
I don't know.
How is Brutus introduced, or
right? That is the question, isn't it? How is Brutus introduced? What will be the? I guess the first time that Naomi can control her powers really will be in a showdown against him in the finale.
Or I guess like the potential fallout, the immediate fallout is going to be is how long Naomi goes before confronting her parents, and what do they have to say about it?
Right. Yeah, like what is going to be their reason for keeping it from her?
You know what? Like the delusional part of me for like a second when I found they were aliens, like, wait, are they her real parents? They're like, no way. That's not how genetics work. But, I mean, I feel like
alien genetics. Like,
I'm not going to lie. When during the episode when they were like, she doesn't know the full story or whatever, I didn't tell her the full story. I thought that it was going to be Desimbato was actually her dad.
And that makes sense. That is
so and obvious. then I thought Jen and Zimbardo had an affair, and I was like, but no. Well, maybe still maybe.
Well, anyway, we'll find out in 3 weeks. So in the meantime, we're going to move over to side B, which is the Flash Afterlife Payback. When Barry and Chester discover another Black Flame victim, they take a flame sample back to the lab. While Team Flash struggle to figure out the identity of the fire meta, Chester is troubled by what he sees in the flames and has waking nightmares of the flame escaping and coming to get him. Allegra notices that his discomfort and gets him to reveal that his father, the story of how his father died in a fiery car crash, and that Chester believes the flame meta is his father's vengeful spirit. Nightmare becomes reality when the flame does escape its containment unit and does indeed seem to be targeting Chester. The flame takes the form of Chester's dad and asks him to join him in the afterlife, basically. Cecile uses her powers of minding other people's business and discovers that the flame is filled with its own emotions, including grief and the desire to feed on Chester's grief. So it's overwhelming grief that's coming off of this thing. And underneath that feeling that's oppressing Chester is the flame meta's desire to feed on Chester's grief. Is what Cecile's feeling. And they're like, that's not your dad. He's like, yeah, but he looks like my dad. And I'm just feel so bad that I didn't have the opportunity when I was alive to tell him that I loved him because he thought I hated him for most of my life, and so did I. So Chester is feeling all of this grief and regret towards his dad, and he's being drawn towards a flame monster. Meanwhile, this flame is impervious to wind and frost, which means nothing can stop the spread until Chester confronts his ghost and forgives himself for not being there when his dad died, not having that closure over his dad's death. So he finally is able to do that. The flame disappears, but they come to the conclusion that there is no person controlling the flame. The flame itself is the meta, which makes it that much harder to figure out how to stop. Meanwhile, Iris gets a health check from Dion and tells him about her memory loss and her confusion over her time sickness. Worried if she should tell Barry, Dion tells her wait until he can consult the forces and get like a full diagnostic. when she goes to CC Media, Sue Dearborn drops by for a business slash social visit. She owns the building for CC Media, so she's checking in on that and just checking in on Iris and before she heads out to Coast City. And she tells Iris and Allegra rumors of a meta that's walking through walls in Coast City. So needing a distraction, Iris pulls executive privilege over Allegra and hops on the first class ticket with Sue to Coast City to get the scoop on this meta while Sue checks out all the properties in Coast City that Dearborn family own. So she's taking over for her embezzling parents that are in jail. While they are out on their own little version of a ghost hunt, Iris confesses to Sue about her time sickness and her fears about what it means. And Sue encourages her to, you know, don't run away from your fears. You have to face your fears, even if it's not good news. It's still coming. You can't stop it. Face it and figure out what to do. While on their search in Coast City, they do find their phantom. And it's a girl named Tanya. They find her at Coast City CC Jitters, which looks exactly the same layout as Central City CC Jitters. Tanya is not open to having a conversation or interview. And Iris kind of picks up on the fact that Tanya has fears of her own that she's afraid to face. So Sue and Iris convince Tanya to help her with using Iris's excellent reporting skills and a lot of Dearborn bravado. They convince Tanya to let them help her. And at the end of the episode, you have Iris in her hotel suite that Sue bought, talking to Barry about her day over Skype. And they kind of, you know, both discuss their own ghosts they've been dealing with and their respective, like, work situations. But afterwards, when she hangs up with Barry, she gets another surprise visit from Dion, and he does not have good news. So whatever Iris was scared of before has now come to a head, and she has to face it, and it's not good. Stefan Plesinski directed the episode, written by Jeff Hirsch. What sparked joy?
So much. First, I was so glad that Iris went with Sue and not Allegra for a second. I was like, Thankfully, Iris pulled rank, as she should. Even though I was like, oh, poor Allegra, but also I don't care. Because Allegra didn't even... Yes?
Well, not question, comment. At first, I thought it was going to be the three of them, and I was like, please no. So I am glad it was, like, just Iris and Sue.
Just the two of us. Yes. But, you know, the fact that Allegra didn't even do her job while Iris was away and was just in our lives shows that Iris should have gone anyway. So, anyway, it was a nice team up. It was really nice to get to see Allegra and Sue interact more and to have someone actually notice this stuff is going on with Iris, ask her about it, get her to open up, and offer advice. Also, I love the concept of Iris trying to go after new metahumans to help them acclimate to their situation and to help, like, tell their story like she did with the streak. It was a nice callback to season one of The Flash, to brighter and better days when we were full of hope. And Sue was also just a badass. I loved her thing with the paperweight where she pretended like it was a destabilizer, and loved how she, you know, hyped up Iris in that moment too. I also liked Tanya, or you pronounce her name. I felt bad for her. I was interested in her backstory, and invested in Iris and Sue helping her. Plus, we got to see how rich Sue is, which is super nice. I also hope that for the future, this means that Iris will actually go out and find more metas and try to help other people who have been, you know, turned against their will or who don't know what to do with their powers, etc., or who just want to become, you know, the helper, the city helper in their neighborhood. Also thought that Brandon McKnight did a great job with Chester's emotional breakdown. I really felt for him. He made it feel realistic, even if the situation was not realistic. And it was nice to see Allegra be there for him, understand him, and for them to just, like, firmly establish how much they mean to each other despite, you know, dancing around the romantic element of it. Also, I like the concept of this, like, Dementor-like villain that feeds off of grief, fear, pain, etc., and can psychologically mess with its victims. It'll be interesting to see what road that takes us down in the near future. And then, you know, I liked the Zoom call with Barry and Iris in that we're seeing Iris think about how what she's going through might affect Barry, because he's talking about how, if anything happened to you, it would be the worst. And then she's like, oh my God, we're going to get through another, like, Barry no showering. He's not going to shave. He's going to forget how to be the Flash. I guess I should figure something out. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really like this episode a lot more than I thought I was going to like it, I guess, because, you know, we finally got Iris' time sickness and not an explanation. We got, like, questions regarding, like, why do I have time sickness? How does someone get this, I don't know, disease or whatever? So that was really interesting. And just the general focus on Iris's feelings, because I feel like we've gotten inklings of what might be going on, but we never had her perspective on, you know, how she feels about having this thing and losing time and being scared and things like that. So I really like the fact that they pair her off with Sue, who is a great character, and I'm so glad that she's untethered from Ralph in general so that she can come back on the show occasionally, and that she was able to, you know, in 2 seconds figure out that Iris was clearly running from something and to chat with her about it, which I think was really great, because we got to see, you know, we got to find out Iris's perspective on things and the fear that she has, which I don't really think she gets to talk about too often on the show. So that was just a great conversation, and they just made a great team in general. I was very entertained throughout as they tried to, like, find the meta and, you know, going through the copycat jitters because, you know, they must. So their report was really good throughout the episode, and I hope that she stays for the next episode so we can, like, get a little bit more of that. Iris just pulling rank over Allegra because, you know, I feel like Allegra deserved that punishment because it's like, you need to go fix whatever you did with the other writer and you need to stay here to do it.
I don't know what she thought. She's like, oh, to go city on, and, like, on Sue's money. Why did you assume that, girl?
Yeah, so it's like, I don't know, editor-in-chief, she needs to go. So I love that. And just in general, like, the general pacing of the episode was good, except for, like, the last few minutes where I wish we'd gotten more of Iris. And even, like, a little West Allen scene, even though it was on video. And I, you know, I'll talk about that later. But it was nice that they were, like, catching up with each other's day, which I assume they do every day. So that was just really nice to, you know, see that Barry does continue to be worried about Iris, even though she's not around and he doesn't know about the time sickness. But he's still, like, there's a really weird grief thing cloud going around, so I don't want you to be a part of that. So their conversation is really nice, and just, like, the idea of Iris wanting someone to become a hero because, you know, her riding on the streak, you know, boosted Barry's career as a superhero. So I really like her continued optimism with regards to, like, metas doing good in the cities that they occupy. Over in the other plot, I really like the fact that, like, we got more of this villain. It's an interesting villain just because it's not, like, a physical person as we've gotten in the past. So the manifestation of this cloud kind of, like, preying on people's fears and people's grief and just their all their bad feelings is really imaginative, even if the CGI is not. But it was just really, nice to see, like, how that poses a challenge for Team Flash, and, like, how are they going to get rid of something that doesn't really exist physically in that sense. And I really like the fact that we got a little bit more on Chester and his grief with regards to his father, and just I really like the cute moments between him and Allegra, kind of like she's being there for him and sensing that something is really off because, you know, they are more than they're friends, and maybe more so later on, but, like, their relationship is beyond just, like, playing D&D, right? It actually is like, I care about you, so I'm worried. So that was really cute. Yeah, just a solid episode in general.
I was so pleasantly surprised that this episode opened up with Iris and that scene with Dion. Because I was not expecting that, because I don't think they were in, she wasn't in the promo at all for the episode. So I wasn't expecting to open up with her. And to open up with such a long scene with her and Dion about her time sickness and actually talking about it, what could it be? The fact that he didn't remember Armageddon, which I thought was weird since he's like time. Like, how do you not know? So the fact that she like remembers, it's almost like the same as Barry, that Barry remembers different timelines that he goes to, that she can remember this as well, but it doesn't seem like Dion does. So there's a little bit more mystery there to what's going on with her. You know, they have this whole like uninterrupted conversation about it. So I was really pleasantly surprised that we're getting so much of her in the first like opening minutes. And I was surprised how much, it feels like weird to say I was surprised how much, since she was in the B plot of the synopsis, it felt like the A plot since we started with her. But the fact that I'm surprised that we have so much of her is a sign of the times, I guess. But I liked that. I like that Sue was back. I love that even though Sue has not been a regular or constant presence on the show, it seems to have been established with very few episodes she has been in since the whole Ralph thing, that, you know, one, she did buy Iris a building, and two, they seem to have kind of like a friendship or rapport or whatever. I like the idea of what draws Iris to Coast City is that there's meta out there, and the fact that, I guess, I know that we've established particle accelerated metas, but I guess it's not very well established of meta events happening outside of Central City. So the fact that this is a new event, so to speak, coming up in a new way that metas can be created or formed was really interesting. So I liked Iris getting, that's the reason why she goes to Coast City. I liked going to a different place and visiting a different location, because I feel like we never do that. So I thought that was interesting. I like the rapport between Sue and Iris. Like, Iris is, she's a reporter with gumption, but in terms of like her personality, she is a little bit more shy, I guess, or reserved, it feels like, in how she holds things, whether that's through the writers just not letting her express her feelings or whatever. Holding things close to her chest because she doesn't want to like burden other people. She's always there for other people, but not really having anybody there for her. And I like that Sue kind of picks up immediately that there's another reason why she took this trip to Coast City, that she's running away from something. And I like that for the first time, it seems like in ever, maybe, Iris has had someone, it is the first time ever, I think, outside of her dad marginally and Barry, that someone has asked Iris about, there's something off with you, first of all. I see something's wrong with you. What is it? And she's been able to express her feelings. And I don't know, you know, we can't really say with everything that went down with the actor whose name that I can't remember at this moment that plays Ralph. Everything that went down with him, if he had stayed on and Sue had become a regular with him, she probably would have been, I could say like what I would have hoped, but I can probably, in reality, she would have been just relegated to being best friends with everybody. So I guess like the silver lining of her not happening and Brock not being around, therefore her not being full time, is that she, when she comes back for purpose, it's usually for Iris or to support Iris in some kind of way. So I like that, even though we don't see her a lot, it does feel like finally Iris has a person on her level, on her age length, on her wavelength, that she can kind of open up to and talk to. And I think that they made like a really good team. Like, Iris is like the good cop to Sue's bad cop. I liked seeing them team up, and the little trap that they set for Tanya. Because when Sue said that, you know, I talked to my friend Star Labs and they sent this over. I'm like, when did they do this? Because I see Star Labs and they're like totally freaked out about this Ghost Meta thing. So when they have time to do that? So the fact that was like a blip, I thought was really smart of Sue. And I like, you know, that coupled with Iris's reporting skills and the fact that she did her due diligence and, you know, really kind of Sue gave her space to convince Tanya that they would want to help them. So I liked all of that in that side of the episode. And then with the Black Flame, I think the concept of it being not a person is really interesting. And especially with Chester and how it was attacking him, because we didn't really know, you know, from the previous episode, excuse me, you have the hotness being falsely accused. So it's just like, you know, trying to figure out the motivation and the fact that it's preying on grief or different strong emotions in people, I think is really interesting to figure out how are they going to stop this. The fact that you can't blow it away, you can't, frost powers don't work on it. What will work? How do you connect to something that isn't really alive in the sense that we know of, like, the concept of life? I liked Chester's, you know, when we finally, because I feel like it took a little bit too long to get him to open up about what it is he was scared about. But when he did open up, I liked that, those conversations with Allegra about his dad and what the regret that he felt about his dad's death, the flashbacks. I loved, like, when he was finally standing up to the flames and, you know, like, my dad would not want me to do this. There was this little montage of if his dad was still alive and if they had reconnected, then this is how, you know, Chester would have showed him around Star Labs and this is how his dad would have reacted. I thought that was a really nice way to kind of add closure to Chester's grief and unresolved feelings about his dad's stuff. I thought that was really nice. I could say a lot of stuff about Chester and Allegra. I think it's written. The words are the way they wrote it out. It was written well, and I feel like if we cared about either character to the extent at which, to the same level as the writers are writing them, then I felt like it would have been, like, great emotionally for me. But on paper, I think it was written really, really well. I guess I'll leave it that way. What did not spark joy?
The way that that statement didn't sound joyful at all.
No! Objectively, it was written very nicely.
Yes, I agree. Fair. I agree that objectively it was written very well. Yay, yeah. To Allegra, although apparently Brandon McKnight said that he prefers a Lester, and I'm like, I'm sorry, sir. That is unacceptable.
Interesting.
A Lester?
Old. Yeah, exactly. That sounds like an old British man. So we're going to call it Allegra, and he will just have to deal with it. Anyway, for me, one issue is that I feel like if this had happened in an earlier season and we still had a budget and we still had hopes and dreams, Central City and Coast City would look very different. We get to explore what is the different about Coast City. Like, how are people different there? How are things different there? How is the jitters different aside from just like a little extra green? I felt like we could have done more with the concept of Coast City. Plus, you know, like, it would be nice if we had some continuity, like, Linda went to Coast City many moons ago. I know that they can't bring Melissa Chow on, but they could mention Linda or whatever. Something to, like, add to the connectivity of the universe that I feel like has been lacking in recent seasons. Aside from that, I thought, even though I liked Brian McKnight's performance and I did like the Chester and Allegra scenes that came out of it and the whole, like, the concept, I felt like jumping into Chester feeling guilty about his dad and then from there extrapolating that to, well, I guess my dad is this ghost metahuman that is now haunting me for the sin of, like, having been mad at him previously or, like, letting him die in the fire or whatever, you know? His problems were with his dad even after resolving
his issues with the dad last season was odd. I feel like we could have had something leading up to it, like in the previous episode where it was Barry's dad's birthday, and that's why he was feeling the feels. I don't know why he would just see the fire image, especially when last week it was already burned people.
The flame was like, oh my God, a new victim. And yeah. Then showing him his dad's face. So I think he saw his dad's face in something.
But like, why was he thinking about his dad that the thing would have seen him as a victim in that moment? Like, why Chester over others? Because there's nothing for his grief to have been more present than other people's in that moment to start it. So I would have liked something to start it so we could see how it led there. Because, like, even in the script or in the scenes, Allegra's like, you don't even believe in ghosts. Like, because if he doesn't even believe in ghosts, why would that be his conclusion? Why not, like, I'm going crazy because I'm thinking about my dad because of, like, whatever reason, you know? He's like, no, it is my dad, and he is haunting me. I was like, why did he kill these other people first, Chester? Please think about this. Anyway, I just feel like it could have been placed somewhere either where we know more about the meta so that it becomes, like, a clearer reason for Chester to think it's personal, or that it would have been not so literal, like, that he made that very literal leap that then even Allegra's like, there's literally no reason for you to think this. So yeah, that was my issue with that concept. And then finally, whereas last week I was wondering why it seems like Iris is not bothered by her time sickness, and now we've learned that she was actually checking it out. So like, I'm glad she's checking it out. But then when Dion comes in and is like, you do have time sickness. What does that mean? I don't know. I just looked it up on WebMD and I saw that time sickness matched with your symptoms currently. I will come back and tell you more later, and also don't tell Barry, because we don't know, and he can't do anything. And then Iris is like, good plan, I guess I won't tell Barry. I was like, is that really a good plan? Are we really smart to not tell Barry and just, like, stay in Coast City, apparently? Where Barry's like, I think we should continue to not have scenes together, so you should stay in Coast City, where you won't die. And Iris is like, or will I? And I was like, this seems like something that we should deal with together, but okay. So yeah, I just felt like the reasoning for that was very weak because it is not an in-universe reason. It is an out-of-universe reason. So yes, there you go.
If this was season three, Iris would tell Barry. He'd be freaking out. We'd all love this for us.
Yep.
It would be amazing. But here we are, several seasons later, and I guess the biggest thing for me is just, like, sensing this distance between them because, you know, Barry's the Flash. Coast City is, like, one city over. You can easily just speed your way there to see your wife, but they're video chatting, and I don't understand this. I know technology is beautiful and everything, but, you know, when you can run to Italy very quickly and come back, you can just go to Coast City and come back. Like, it's not, she can stay there, but you can go visit her. So I just think that it's just a bizarre choice to have because I like that Iris is finally exploring the time sickness stuff, but it still feels very separate to what Team Flash is doing. And even with, like, the investigation of the meta, I also feel like she could be investigating this grief meta thing, whatever's happening over in Central City 2. Like, that could be a storyline that is intricately, you know, connected to both. And it's just strange that the writing continues to create this separation when it could be blossoming and, you know, being the best it can be. But I feel like the pacing of the storylines in general is still not that great. Like, we get a little bit of this, we get a little bit of that, and it never feels like a fully realized thing. Even like with Chester, like, when was the last time we talked about Chester's dad? It was like 2 seasons ago, right? Like early season 6 when Cisco was still around.
Yes.
So it just, like, after all this time to bring him back up, and, you know, Chester's great and everything, but it's just, like, interesting considering the fact that we had last week, like you said, Tati, like, an episode about grief and Barry. So I know that every character, they're trying to give, like, a story to every character, but you also don't necessarily need to do that. Or at the very least, like, it would be interesting if it was both Barry and Chester experiencing something. Yeah, it's just like an interesting choice, interesting story choices, and I don't know what's next, but like I'm intrigued. But like the way that they're creating this distance, especially between like Barry and Iris and the two separate stories, is just very strange to me.
Yeah, I feel like it is strange that I feel like the connection is that they are both dealing with like quote unquote phantoms. One girl that walks the walls and one that's just like a ghost of like dead relatives coming to haunt you. But other than that, the weirdest thing for me was that because we opened it with Iris and Theon. So the week before we opened it with Barry and Iris in the apartment for like a minute and he had to go and then they left and went separate ways. So this one we didn't open up with Barry and Iris in the apartment. No one mentions her off hand or casually what the other is doing. Like when Allegra got rejected for the field trip to Coast City. And so she was like hanging out at Star Labs all day. Not once she should say or mention that, oh yeah, boss is going to Coast City to follow on a meta story. Barry didn't ask. And there's no mention of like, where is my wife or what is she doing? Or I wonder what Iris is doing or any kind of like when they're trying to figure out stuff. Cause in previous seasons when they've had to a meta or whatever that they didn't know anything about and couldn't find, that was one of Iris' strengths is that she's a reporter and that she could look up stuff and, you know, in concert with Joe at CCBD doing investigations that way. You have Iris is also doing investigations through like reporting and you know, talking to people. So I just thought it was very odd throughout the entire episode. There was no kind of like offhand comment of, well, I could ask Iris, but she's out of Coast City and I don't want to bother her or anything like that. So towards the end of the episode, I was like, I swear to God, if there is no, just like, does Barry even know that she went to Coast City with Sue? Like, what is going on? And then the next scene was the West Island Skype talk. So I was like, okay, thank God. Somewhere during the day, there was communication that Iris is no longer in Central City with Barry. But then I think May, you or somebody else on Twitter was like, but why is it on Skype? Because I thought it was a very cute
scene. That was me. I don't understand. Yeah.
And it was like a West Island type conversation and intimacy that we had been missing for so long. So I thought it was great. And I thought it was cute over Skype. But then you're like, but he could have run there. And I was like, oh, yeah. Like, he could have run there. And so when you think about that, it kind of makes it less so. Like, why didn't you run there? Like, if they could run to Italy with 8 people a week or two ago on a whim for brunch, which is stupid. I think that's a stupid display of his power. It's like, and they're always running to Europe. Like, let's be less white, please, and run to other places. But anyways, the fact that they could just casually do that for one episode, but here she's not even in a different country. She's just in like a different, I don't know, I guess it's a different state. Coast City's got to be on a coastline somewhere. And it's not like he has no reason why he couldn't have run there. So it does, on the one hand, it just feels like, oh, great. Now we finally have the West Island intimacy that we've been used to before. But then when you put that in context with the fact that there's like a physical distance over Skype, you're just kind of like, oh, but you're sad again. That kind of thing. And then with the black flame side of it, Allegra and Chesta, objectively, I think it was written the way that it should have been written in terms of growing them as like a couple. Non-objectively, subjectively, I don't think there's enough fan involvement or investment in either of those characters to put that much investment into the scenes that they gave them. I felt some of the scenes were kind of long. I felt that every time they have a scene, they have to say that they play D&D together. I'm just like, I get it. You play Dungeons and Dragons. Dungeons and Dragons. I don't need that reference. That's like the only thing that they do together. And I feel like that's redundant, and I don't need to hear it less. I get it. Like, stop saying it every time. Like, you have to have, like, more in common than Dungeons and Dragons or something.
And that was, like, the intrusion of Cecile.
Yes. That was my next point. The fact that she is always third willing in somebody's relationship. The fact that moments that, you know, should have been between Chester and Allegra, she's also there. And it feels... she just feels out of place a lot of times because she's always in someone else's relationship. And it's weird. It's getting weird.
Because hers no longer exists.
I guess so.
Yeah.
What did Sonia and Anita and Suara have to say?
Suara says, what? A scene where Iris gets the space to express the trauma she's been through? Candace was amazing this episode, and whenever she gets the focus she deserves, loved Sue being her friend and confidant and them working together to help the meta teenager. Am I scared for what will happen next? Absolutely. And if Candace, for some nonsensical reason, isn't irregular, I will absolutely not watch the show. Hopefully that's not the case. I actually quite enjoyed the Blackfyre. I feel like that's a reference to Starfire's sister plot. And Chester had some pretty good plot lines. Did it make sense to me why he felt unloved by his father, given what we've seen previously? Absolutely not. But alas, I cannot expect consistency from this show anymore, or for it to be the baseline, to be baseline good. Side note, I skipped most of the non-Iris scenes from last week's episode. At this point, I'm just in it for her. All the best, Suara. Same, Suara. Anita says, hi, ladies. I just had a couple more things. The video chat was sweet. It really was, but I hope that's not the extent. Oh, wait, did Anita have something else that I missed?
Yeah, she sent an email and then she added to it.
Oh, okay, I see. Anita says, if it's one thing that The Flash does right in this slow motion dumpster fire, it's real estate. The West Allen loft has a bright, shiny new look, so does the Citizen Media headquarters, and catch Iris's 5-star digs at La Vie Dorée. Wrapping Iris's time sickness storyline around the episode was the right thing to do. Pure joy. And it's a bit reassuring that Dion has her back in all of this. But oh no, the look of concern on his face. The news is not good. It's going to be okay, Iris. Get under this blanket. And I'll bring you some soup. The show is sliding that hashtag for Phantom in there. Are you trying to trend the next graphic novel or something, my dear show? Honestly, I've lost interest in following Eric's plan for The Flash. What he said about Allegra helming Citizen Media still annoys. I don't even like it as a temporary arrangement because Allegra has no management skills. This is very true. By the time Iris is cured, she could come back to an office in flaming chaos. Did you all peep that Allegra was also eager to escape the newsroom? She knows she can't let Taylor catch her in the street because destruction. I love that trip for Iris and love the dual storylines for Candace. Iris deserves to be known on the West Coast for the excellent journalist that she is, and Candace deserves the material. It also sparked joy for Sue to check in with Iris. Are you good? How's your marriage? Yes, this illness represents the unknown, and you're scared, but you can face it. Now that Gotham is a teensy quiet between monsters, I just need for Ryan to drive in and take Iris to lunch. I love that Iris figured out how to track down the new meta and is getting her story. With Tinia able to phase through walls and Kramer able to mimic meta powers, the team is bloating again. No give backs in Iris' journalism progress, dear show. So about the Black Flame subplot, I know The Flash is fast, but nanoseconds do matter. Could have just alerted Barry on the app so he went straight there, and the survivor could have given the team vital information. But I guess it didn't have the VFX budget for another confrontation scene and interview scene too. But that could have been avoided. That could have avoided some Star Labs contrivances.
I agree with that, because when the alarm went off and Barry came there first, I'm like, why are you here when you should be there?
So we wouldn't have to put up with whatever choices Danielle Nicolet made that she called acting. Sorry. I did enjoy the creepy aspect of the Black Flame. The fact that it preys on grief can appear and disappear so freely is pretty dangerous. We did not need Cecile for any of what she did in the episode, and her tendency to go back and forth on the ethics of reading people's emotions without consent is irritating. Sadly, I predict that it's going to go after Cecile, probably as some concocted empath bait, and we have to and we have to put up with more of that acting.
We have to put up the acting.
Yeah, like, if she goes after her mom, she's like, great. Oh no, my mom died too. Also, what Killer Frost said about how it's wrong for Chester to keep super personal things from Team Flash is itself wrong. You got to leave him with autonomy over his inner self and leave some emotional space for Allegra. One thing sparked joy in the Blackfire investigation was Barry phasing out of the crime scene and reappearing in seconds with the canister. Barry being smart and capable and is always entertaining. There is no hope for the Allegra and Chester floaty that Eric is trying to pass off as a ship. Brandon and Kayla are both strong actors and great in their own roles, but they either have no chemistry or they are being badly directed. What was that awkward thing they did at the end of the confrontation? A hug? And since when does a budding ship include a third wheel? Cecile, also none of their ship names roll off the tongue. A Lester sounds like molester, so no. To me, the main storyline in this phase is Iris's time sickness, and the strong B plot is how Iris is building out citizen media, despite a brawl about to erupt between Allegra and the new staff she doesn't respect. And then Anita adds, the video chat was sweet, it really was, but I hope that's not the extent of their moments. Barry did say it was safer for her there, but he could have run to Coast City to spend time with his wife, yes. And for Iris to hide while this thing is threatening Central City doesn't sound like her. Okay, that's it for me. Thank you so much, Anita. And then Sonia's feedback. I hate that they moved the Flash to Wednesdays because now it's even harder to get my feedback in before the deadline. I don't have cable anymore, so I can't watch the Flash when it airs and have to wait until the next day. And in order to get my feedback in on time, I have to wake up early to watch. And sometimes that's hard to do. Oh, well, we appreciate you either way, Sonia. Anyways, here's some feedback from last week's episode. I like this episode with the storyline about Barry's dad's birthday. I'm going to skip last week's, sorry, Sonia, because it's going to...
We'll post it on Tumblr,
I promise. For this week's episode, both storylines this week were actually good, which is a first for The Flash. Maybe they should continue to add Iris-centric storylines into the show to make the show more watchable. I agree. Nice to see Dion helping Iris with the time sickness again and how she talks about missing out on time and whatnot, but also that neither Iris or Dion remember the train station thing from Armageddon and that Dion is seeing something new in Iris, so hopefully we can get more time sickness stuff soon. Can someone please explain why Chester and Allegra have to bring up D&D literally every time they talk to each other because it's getting annoying? Love seeing Mika Abdullah, who plays Tinia, as I've enjoyed her acting on some of the other shows she's been on, and she's partly Lebanese. Oh, yay! So it's nice to see a partly Lebanese show. Great to see Sue again, and nice that they are giving her storylines without Ralph and how she truly cares about what Iris is going through and wants to help her. Iris being able to find out who Tinia was, like she is an ace reporter, and how she was able to get through to Tinia to help her.
Is her name Tinia, not Tanya? Because I don't know why I have that confused.
I guess it's Tinia because it's been in all the emails, so it must be.
Well, damn.
We love seeing our amazing BAMF doing her thing and helping people. The Blackfire storyline was cool and terrifying at the same time, and interesting with Chester seeing his dad in the flames and how the other victims were getting their emotions fed on by the killer. Whenever they said it was Blackfire, I kept thinking of Titans, but it's probably not the same character as that show. I guess Cecile has no problem reading people's feelings without feeling conflicted about it anymore. Now that's not helpful for the plot. Speaking of relationships, I loved when Sue called Iris and Barry the couple of the century because, yes, that is true. Cecile reading Allegra and Chester's love for each other, just stop, please. Oh, my God. But there is some semblance of character growth for her that she didn't say anything and just left, so there's that. The end scene with yet another cliffhanger about Iris and her time sickness. If we don't get an actual time sickness storyline next episode, I will be so mad. Also, if this godforsaken show ends before Iris gets a Pulitzer Prize on screen, I will sue Eric for emotional damage, I swear to God. Anyways, can't wait for the next episode and hope the rest of the season is as good as this episode was. P.S. Are we going to do Bridgerton season 2? Yes, we are. Because you and someone else on Tumblr asked us, we will be covering Bridgerton season 2 and the steaminess that it was. But do we have any feedback for the
You read the feedback, girl.
I guess we can go into predictions.
We have feedback for this season. that is hard. I wonder if, like, because I feel like Iris can't disappear from the episodes now just because she's in Coast City, right? So I assume she's going to continue to work with Tinia.
I think it's Tanya.
Tanya. All right. Well, she's going to continue to work with Phantom Girl. And and then from there, I don't know. I wonder if that she'll disappear from Coast City. And then that's why Barry won't know what
happened. There was one synopsis. I think 8/12 synopsis is out. And it was like, and it was about Barry and Dion saving Iris from time sickness. Mm-hmm. So some crisis is averted with her. And then they have to, like, figure out what to do. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Interesting. So, I don't know. Oh, wait. Here's my actual prediction. Either if the Black Flame thing isn't Ronnie, then Caitlin will have to deal with it acting as Ronnie to her, and then hopefully they'll get flashbacks to their time together, because we missed most of it, and that will be her final, like, reckoning, in which she'll fully move on, I guess, and be with Marcus. Or Marcus is literally Black Flame Man. Because
I think also in that, I'm trying to, like, look up, okay. So, 812, Death Rises synopsis. After saving Iris from phasing out of time. And we're at 809, right?
Yes.
It's this episode.
Watched 809. So, three more episodes.
812, Death Rises. After saving Iris from phasing out of time, Barry and Dion work on a potential fix for her sickness. Meanwhile, Caitlin helps Marcus to understand his newfound abilities, while a mysterious red speedster arrives from an alternate, I guess, universe. So apparently, Marcus does... Marcus does have latent meta abilities. I assumed it had something to do with plants. But I guess it's possible. It could be possible that it has something to do with, like, the flame or whatever. But
Interesting. Okay, well, you know, at least we're not dropping it. So I guess we'll get a little bit sprinkled in before Iris disappears for, like, 5, 3, 4 episodes. I don't know.
I was trying to find the other episode that listed our... Sorry, there's a tweet that listed some of the titles for The Flash were released. But I cannot find the tweet at this moment. Hold on, but I think one of them... I think 814 was like a friend's funeral. A funeral for a friend.
812 is Death Rises. Episode 813 is Death Falls. 814 is Funeral for a Friend.
Yeah, and that's the last one that we know that Candace shot for, because we saw her in the funeral get up, and then she'd be out for 15 seconds.
And 816 is The Curious Case of Bartholomew Allen,
which is the one that Katie Lotz is directing.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. I don't know. Interesting. Funeral for a Friend. Maybe Marcus dies. I don't know.
Marcus could die. That would be Caitlin's pattern. Oh, that was another thing. Like the casual offhand mentioned that, you know, because first it was like Frost and Chilblain going on impromptu dates all over the place. And then like this episode's like, where's Caitlin? Oh, she and Marcus are doing like impromptu dates all over the place and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, okay, girl, whatever. But anywho, you can meet us here, same Flash time, same Flash place, to discuss The Flash, because I think that's the only show that will be on for next week.
With Gumption of the Week?
Oh, no. Yeah, we do need to do that. So what are our nominees for Naomi and for The Flash? For Naomi, I'm going to say Jen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jen, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Because I thought the contingency plan was, like, genius, and I'm giving her full credit. Sorry, Greg.
For The Flash, I guess I'd be torn between Iris and Sue.
Yeah. I would lean towards Sue, just because I feel like she gave Iris the kick that Iris needed to hear at the moment. And she just had so much like bravado of, you know, Loki or Heike threatening this girl with whatever, with a paperweight.
Who do we give it overall, I guess?
I feel like Jen.
Same.
Yeah.
Lean towards Jen. Because she had the contingency plan. She saved her daughter. And then she had the audacity to be an alien. So we're going to go with Jen as our Lady with Gumption of the Week. Thank you for joining us. We will be back next week. If you have feedback that you would like to submit, you can send it to us at ladiesofbegumption@gmail.com. Follow along with us on Twitter for live tweets of the episodes, or send us asks on Tumblr, ladiesofbegumption.tumblr.com. If you want to join Patreon, you can join that so you can listen to all of our thoughts on the Bridgerton season 2. And we will see you next week for The Flash 8:10.
Bye. Bye.